Okay, today is May 29th, 2018. This is an oral history interview with Howard Moore. We're here at Steenbach Memorial Library inside the University Archives. And my name is Troy Reeves. And Howard, I already know this is too soft, so I'm going to turn this up. Okay, so Howard, for sound quality purposes, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure, Howard Moore, M-O-O-R-E.
Excellent, all right. Mm-hmm. So, and you can speak normal voice. Okay. It'll pick you up just fine.
All right.
Okay, so as I said before we turned on the recorder, the first question is kind of a broad one, mm-hmm. but you know, what brought you here to UW?
Well, when I was a senior in high school at William Howard Taft High School in Chicago, I always loved the Big Ten growing up. Was fascinated by the Flying Illini, being a Chicago kid, but remember a year ago, before I was coming out, that Illinois lost at Wisconsin in the field house to a pretty good Wisconsin team that wound up going to the NIT that year. And then I always heard good things about Madison. So when I came to visit, I had an expectation that I would probably like it more than Northwestern, more than Iowa, Iowa State, and the other schools that were recruiting me. And when I got here, I fell in love. I knew this was the place for me. The people here have always been the reason why UW has been dear to my heart. The teammates I had at the time were phenomenal. They were the first indication that I was going to be happy here. And then just walking the campus, seeing the lakes, how different it was from Chicago. You know, it just all was breathtaking from a scenic perspective. So, you know, I knew this was the place for me, and I committed on my visit.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. Growing up in Chicago, how did you become interested in basketball?
Well, you know, it's funny. My dad was always an athlete, specifically basketball, but softball. You know, in Chicago, we played 16-inch softball, so we always played that. You know, there was always some type of sport going on, you know, with my father. So he would take me along with him to go play basketball in the rec leagues and stuff like that. And he was a pretty good athlete. And so I just picked it up from him, watching it on TV, and just being in Chicago where it's so competitive and so people are so driven to be the best player ever. Mm-hmm. That competition just kind of got immersed in my world. And I just fell in love with the game at an early age.
So who were some of the players that you started to play against?
I'll start with who I watched, because I think that's more important. You know, just the people that I idolized, because I was a big DePaul fan growing up. Okay. So growing up in the 70s and the 80s, DePaul in Chicago was like the ultimate team. And they were players that I could relate to because they were from my neighborhood. Guys like Mark Aguirre, Teddy Grubbs, Skip Dillard. You know, it was just, there was so, Bernard Randolph, there were so many players, Terry Cummings, you know, guys like that, that were Chicagoans, and they played in DePaul, and they treated them like rock stars, you know, and they were better than the Bulls at the time. The Bulls, this was before Jordan got there, and the Bulls were so bad that everyone just latched onto the DePaul Blue Demons, and they had WGN, so before ESPN took off, and you see college basketball every night. The Blue Devils, the Blue Demons had WGN, and that gave them the ability to recruit anywhere in the country because of that, what WGN can do, and you know, the ability to be in every household from coast to coast. So I love DePaul. Those DePaul players were like my idols. Dr. J was like a god to me. You know, I'm old enough to, you know, be able to remember him as a player, and watching him when he first got in the NBA and just taking off from Philly and his first championship, even though they lost it to the Lakers. But when he won it, you know, I was so happy for him. Mm-hmm. To watch the emergence of Michael Jordan right in my eyes in Chicago, and, you know, guys like that. Isaiah Thomas, who's from my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, Ricky Green, who went to Michigan. You know, Craig Hodges. You know, there's just so many guys that from Chicago that you can just – latch yourself onto and watch. Mm-hmm. You know, Marcus Liberty. You know, guys like that that mm-hmm. were just, you know, my idols, seriously. Mm-hmm. Kenny Battle from, you know, Illinois, right. Kendall Gill, you know, I mean, all those guys, Nick Anderson, who used to date my cousin when I was coming up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just so many ties to these great players that I could, you know, latch onto and watch. And now they're friends of mine. So some of them.
Right. So how you talked about some of the places that you were recruited. I wonder if we could just sort of list the places you recruited. You already explained why you chose Madison. Yeah. But
Well, the first scholarship offer I was given was by Northern Illinois. Jim Molinari, who I wound up working for later, ironically, offered my first Division I scholarship. And that was pretty special to me. Followed by Northern Iowa, where the great Eldon Miller, Coach Eldon Miller was there. And he used to coach at Ohio State and went to Northern Iowa and had a good career there. Those were like the mid-major schools that were recruiting me early on. The Green Bays, Dick Bennett, you know, he's at Green Bay. You know, Illinois, Chicago, Loyola, Chicago. You know, those were smaller schools that were recruiting me early. And then Northwestern offered me. That was my first Big Ten offer. And then Ohio State was watching. And then Wisconsin wound up offering as well.
Okay. So you said you committed once you came here.
On my visit, yeah.
I assume that was then, was that like winter of your senior
year? It was actually spring. So I had just finished my senior year. I wanted to play my senior year out because before my senior year, it was the Northern Iowas, the Northern Illinois, the Green Bays, the Loyolas. And then as I played and I got better and played better on a higher stage, that's when the Big Ten schools started coming in. So then I was getting recruited by those schools. So I signed. I committed in April of 1990 and signed in April.
Okay. Was that your first visit to Madison when you came up in April?
Yes. Okay. I flew in with Ray McCallum, who was the assistant for Steve Yoder. And it was a quick flight, obviously. But, you know, getting up here, when you could fly in and you could see the isthmus, that was impressive, you know, and you can see how the layout of the land coming in from a plane. So having that perspective, even though I've driven it a million times now of the past almost 30 years, you know, I can, you know, just remember that view of the isthmus coming in from the plane, which made a bigger impact.
So once you finished playing and you committed to Madison, so this is April. Graduate high school. How did you spend that first summer?
That first summer, they have a summer experience, collegiate experience. I didn't take part in that for some reason. I wish I did. My teammate Tracy Webster was here, and I think I wanted to just spend one more summer in Chicago, if I remember right. So I worked and played and worked on my game a little bit, but I think thinking back, yeah, I wish I could have just got up here and just got acclimated to the school and, you know. But I wanted to have some money to buy some clothes and be prepared for college and have a little bit of money set aside. So I was trying to think like an adult. But at the same time, you know, if I could give myself the advice, I would have came up here earlier and spent that time.
Right.
That would have been better.
So you came up here.
In the fall.
You came up here just like A lot of freshmen who came up here, if they didn't do summer, if they didn't do SOAR or something like that.
Yes, and I was given a map of the campus and my class schedule and was told good luck, and off to class I went. And it was one of the most overwhelming, you know, situations I ever been a part of, trying to find the buildings and looking at the map. I'm sure I looked like a true freshman walking around, you know, trying to figure out which building is Helen C. White and which one is the humanities. And, you know, it was funny.
And you said before we turned on the recorder that you stayed in one of the Lakeshore
dorms. I lived in the Lakeshore dorms, yeah. So I lived in Adams Hall my first year. I think it's Adams Hall La Follette House was the exact and I was on the first floor, so it's like right over there, and like I was on that first floor, so my window was right there, so I used to see everyone walking through, and if people want to know if I was home, they just yell, "Hey, Doug," which my nickname, or knock on the window and see if me or my roommate Cass Weaver, who was my teammate, was there. So
yeah, I was going to ask if you had who your roommate was.
Yeah, so. Cass Weaver, who wound up transferring after our first year, he just wasn't happy. African American gentleman from Rich Central, The same high school that Kendall Gill went to.
Okay.
And but he didn't get along with Coach Yoder very well, and just didn't like the dynamics of the team, and just decided to transfer to Richmond. Mm. Yeah, and play, had a good career there.
Mm-hmm. So when did practices start that first year?
Usually the middle of October. Right. You know, then it's later. Now it's earlier. But yeah, about the middle of October. So until then, from like September until that time, so about a month, you're just doing conditioning and lifting and doing those things to get prepared for the season. And then in October, we started our practices. And back then, we used to have Dick Vitale come in for our little March Madness to kick off the season. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of neat. You know, it was a good environment. You know, we had a dunk contest, and I thrived in dunking. That was my thing. So I didn't win the dunk contest because Carlton McGee was pretty athletic, and mm-hmm. he was a better athlete than I was. And, you know, he wound up winning it. But, you know, those first couple practices were pretty intense. You know, mm-hmm. It taught me that I needed to work and get better. So I redshirted my first year because I just felt I needed to get stronger. I needed to just figure some things out before I got on the court. So taking that that redshirt year was important for me.
Was that important both athletically and academically?
Yes, it was. Yep. It really helped me. My first semester academically was pretty good. Second semester was tough. I had a death in the family, and had an uncle that was killed on the streets of Chicago. And so it just really took a toll on me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just thinking back how things go and how things are now, like depression was something you never even thought about or talked about back then. It was almost taboo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking back to how I was, I'm pretty sure I was depressed. And that was a factor why I didn't do well academically. But I was able to get myself back on track and push through.
So what was a typical practice like? And, you know, I'm sure it changed depending on who the coach was, since mm-hmm. you had three different coaches, right?
5 years.
So maybe start like in the Yoder.
Yeah, with Yoder, it was pretty fundamental, you know, but it was different because my first couple of years we had some guys that were veterans and, you know, kind of pillar names in Wisconsin basketball history. Even though they didn't win Big Ten championships or things of that nature, they were really good players like Willie Sims and Patrick Tompkins, Timmy Locum, you know, guys like that, John Ellenson. You know, I mean, we were a veteran-laden team my true freshman year. And so, you know, we went to the NIT that year in 1990-91. I remember we played Stanford in the first round with a really good Stanford team with Adam Keefe, who was All-American, mm-hmm. and they beat us in the field house. But that group was really good as a team. But we didn't have a point guard. You know, Larry Heisel had to play point guard, and Willie Sims played a little bit. But, you know, we were just – those guys were forwards and wings, and we had no point guard. Tracy Webster had to sit out because he was Prop 48, which at the time was the limitation on student-athletes to, you know, have the academic qualifications mm-hmm. to qualify and play right away, and he didn't meet those qualifications. So, you know, it was just one of those things where, you know, we had a good team. We just was missing that one key element, a general, mm-hmm. a floor general. Mm-hmm. But the practices were competitive. It was weird at first because it almost seemed like, you know, the older guys, as good as they were, you know, always butted heads with head coach Steve Yoder. You know, it's almost mm-hmm. like he was against them and they were against him. And there was this battle every day, you know, a battle of wills. Huh. And it was just an interesting dynamic. I didn't expect that when I first came here. You know, I expected that, just like my high school coach, everyone respected him. Everyone wanted to play hard for him. We loved him. And, you know, it was going to be that way. And when I got here, I just saw conflict and, you know, guys that weren't really bought in for the right reasons and kind of doing their own thing in a way. And I could see that coach was stressed out because, you know, he had to win. You know, he had been here a few years, and like anything else in athletics, you know, he had a new athletic director, a new chancellor. Right. They just hired a new football coach in Barry Alvarez that year. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of new things happening. He wasn't one of the new things.
Right.
So I can tell that there was a little stress on him to succeed. But to go to the NIT at that time, that was good. You know, UW wasn't used to going to postseason. Mm-hmm. And he took us to the first postseason in 42 years in 89. So, but, you know, people was ready to grow to that ceiling and get to the NCAA tournament. And so with Yoder, that was the one thing that he was – I think I keep saying if he was a given time, that was he was going to make that happen. But Stu definitely took it over that next level. Mm-hmm. And when he was able to bring in Rashard Griffith to compliment Michael and Tracy, then that really took us off. And we were ready to make that run to the tournament in 94.
So how many years was Yoder here with you?
Well, I played for him for two. So 90-91, 91-92, and then he was let go in the spring of 92. And then Stu was brought in in the spring of 92.
Okay. So how was it playing? I think looking at your stats, I know you didn't play a lot that first year. Mm-hmm. But what's the difference between being like a redshirt freshman and participating in practice and being
being available
where you actually get to sit on that?
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because now you know there's a responsibility. You know, at first when you're redshirting, there's no pressure. You're there. You're practicing every day, and you're a cheerleader during the games, and you're just. But now, when there's a situation where coach can call your name and grab you and throw you in the game, it's a different story. And, you know, even though my redshirt freshman year, my second year, I was able to, you know, I was ready to make that move. I had became ineligible that second semester. Because, again, still dealing with my uncle's death and just wasn't able to put it together yet. And so I didn't have a good second semester my second year. And so my grades suffered, and I just didn't do well. And I think a little bit of it was, you know, I didn't get on the court much. You know, I had to wait for that time. Mm-hmm. But I think everything together just was – it was just a tough time for me. Mm-hmm. And just growing up and trying to learn how to deal with adversity and all of those things, it was tough.
Right.
You know.
So, I mean, you and I are age cohorts, and you talked earlier about the fact that – you know, depression wasn't really talked about.
Right.
So was there any outlet for you to be able to try to talk through what you felt like you were going through?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, was the one person that I could talk to and help me. And, you know, I could feel like I could be vulnerable with her. And she helped me through it a lot, more than she knows. And through that tough time, she was the one rock that was there. Even though we had supportive coaches, like I remember John Williams, who was one of our assistants, was really supportive and helping me. We had a gentleman that worked in the athletic department named Ed Pollard, an African-American gentleman that understood what I was going through and was there to help. You know, he was very instrumental in helping me get back on track academically and having a plan and a purpose moving forward. You know, so there were people here. But my girlfriend and my wife now was very instrumental in helping me just get refocused and get back on track.
Okay.
And it's funny because it kind of correlates with the Stu, you know, with Stu Jackson coming in. So, you know, Stu Jackson came in. It was a new change. I had a new, you know, had a clean slate. I just came off a knee surgery that spring. So when Stu inherited me, you know, he inherited a guy that was, you know, he heard was a pretty good athlete, but was working on one leg at the time and was trying to work through that rehab. But it was also a fresh start for me academically. So I got a plan. I got back on track. I think I got over the things that I was going through, and I started doing much better academically, and I never looked back. So it was kind of a make or break situation for me my second year. It just kind of showed me how quickly something I wanted so bad could be taken away from me. So I had to refocus, you know, kind of recommit to what was needed to be successful here. And then I was able to do that.
So maybe to bring it to the future, so, going through what you went through, I wonder how do you or do you try to mentor young athletes that are possibly... I mean, I don't know how many of them had an uncle shot like you, but, you know, we all have our own.
We all have difficulties.
Yeah. So I wonder how you try to, you know, take what you learned and apply it.
Well, it's funny because I was doing a speech for the memorial for the La Follette's graduation. And you know, I was just looking at some of my favorite, you know, people in history. Mm-hmm. And one of those people was Frederick Douglass. And I went to Frederick Douglass Middle School in Chicago. And one of the quotes that he gave, and I used it for my speech, and it's a really interesting quote. And I'm just looking it up right here. I don't want to miss, I can't misquote Frederick Douglass, you know. But one of the things he talks about was just your past, and making sure that your past is used, is useful in shaping your present and your future. And I always thought that was pretty powerful. And when you look at my past, you know, it wasn't perfect. You know, I wasn't a blue chip recruit. I wasn't all American. I was just a hardworking kid from Chicago public schools that, you know, kind of overachieved a lot, and, you know, but had big dreams and big aspirations and big goals, and was able to at least get to this point where it was like, hey, okay, you're here now. What are you going to do with it? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think the thing that I can relate to our players is that you don't have to be the NBA player like a Michael Finley. You know, you can still have a role in his team that's pretty substantial. And the great thing about, you know, being a part of the coaching staff now is that people still remember me. And I'm just as popular as a Michael Finley, because I've been able to come here and make an impact in another way. To be able to recruit a, you know, Ben Brust and a Frank Kaminsky and still have make an impact on this program, even more so as a coach than I did as a player. That's pretty, you know, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And it means a lot to me that I'm still able to contribute to this program that gave me so much. Mm-hmm. So from those standpoints, I take it very seriously when I have to mentor players and when I coach them and work with them. I have to understand this isn't a job for me. This is a passion. Mm-hmm. And if you're able to pursue your passion, you're a fortunate person, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my message to the graduates on June 8th is that, you know, figure it out. What is your passion? And once you find out what it is, you better pursue it with all your heart and all your love and all your, you know, your energy, because that's what's going to take you to having a happy, fulfilled life. Mm-hmm. And not just going through the day to day and just feeling, you know, like, you know, the monotony of life. You know, you want to feel fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I help my try to help my players understand and give them a little historical perspective. I try to help them understand it wasn't always like this. You know, the Kohl Center and the Fieldhouse are two different buildings. Mm-hmm. And what we did in the Fieldhouse led to there being a Kohl Center. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always explain to them I take a lot of pride in having a couple of those building blocks in the Kohl Center, mm-hmm. because of the things that we sacrificed and did in our time led to that facility. Mm-hmm. You know, until we went into the NCAA tournament in 94, there was no talk about a new arena. And when we did that, that's when the conversation became real, and they started really investigating an arena and, you know, fundraising, mm-hmm. you know, getting to a point where you can ask Herb Cole for $25 million and mm-hmm. Ab Nicklaus for 10, and, you know, being able to have a sustainable facility for basketball and hockey and women's basketball and women's hockey.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So you just mentioned the field house, and I asked mm-hmm. Richard about this too. Is there a way to describe, particularly because it's been now 20 years that people have watched yeah. games in the Kohl Center,
yeah.
to describe, maybe describe as a player how okay. it was to play
it was awesome.
In the field house?
Awesome. I talk about it, I brag about it all the time to players, to fans, and when I do interviews. The field house, the atmosphere in the field house, it's not even close to what's going on in the Kohl Center. And I mean that from a standpoint of the environment in the field house was much more hungry. It was a liver atmosphere. You could just tell there was a better engagement with the players and the fans because it was so intimate. Mm-hmm. You know, like I can remember, like, you know, like Willie Sims getting an and one and rolling out of bounds, and the fans were right there to pick him up and high-five him. Like, That was the connection we had with the fans in the field house. Plus, it was right on top of you, so it was so loud. And I just remember it being loud, you know, all the time. When we beat the Fab Five in there, Michael Finley's freshman year, And he was the best freshman on the court that day. You know, they talk about the Fab Five all they want. Michael Finley was the best freshman that night. And we beat them. That place was rocking. And those are the memories I'll always have. And, you know, and it was consistent. You know, whether we were, you know, middle of the league, bottom of the league, whatever, you just remember the fans just being so hungry for us to win and behind us the whole time. And that's why you hear about the faithful 5,000 in the field house. And, you know, we have our, you know, our Badger Basketball Booster Club that we still exist. Now, booster clubs are going out of existence, to be honest with you. When you go around the country, you know, you don't see the booster clubs like you used to back in the day. Now it's more of like a Badger fund or a one unit that has, you know, fundraising endeavors for the whole department. We have that, but the booster club's been able to latch on because it's a special group. And that's that Faithful 5,000. You know, when we have functions with them, I feel like it's a family picnic because that's the group that's known me since I was 17 years old when I first got on campus, and I know them. And so it's not this new crowd, and not to dog the Cole Center. I'm not doing that. But the Cole Center just has a different vibe because there was more success in the field in the Cole Center than there was in the field house. So when you have success, you're going to bring a new crowd of people with you. But that crowd didn't suffer with us through those 70s, 80s, and 60s, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a different dynamic, where I think it's – I call it the wine and cheese crowd in the Cole Center because they have all the bells and whistles and amenities mm-hmm. that a new arena brings. And it's almost like the Fieldhouse crowd was kind of pushed to the side a little bit for the dollar. Mm-hmm. And that happens. That's athletics and that's business. And business and athletics has become big business, you know. So with that aspect, that's a part of the growth that UW Athletics has had to go through, to go from a mom and pop shop to what it is today, where there's over $135 million in operating revenue, where in 1989, Pat Richter inherited an athletic department that was $2 million in the red. Mm-hmm. And Donna Shalala did a hell of a recruiting job to get him to leave Oscar Mayer for that job and take a pay cut. You know, I understand that history, you know, but I also understand the alignment that has to take place for a university like this to be successful. Because Donna Shalala proved that you can have a great academic institution and also have a tremendous athletic department as well and winning and have both. Mm-hmm. And she wanted that and she started that. So like I always said, yeah, it's great to have, you know, statues of Pat and Barry out front of Camp Randall. But you're forgetting the little lady that should be out there with you guys, too, because she started it all. Mm-hmm. So, but we're going to honor her in the Hall of Fame this year. So that's a good thing.
That's great.
Yeah. But I saw it firsthand, Troy. I mean, I saw how she was supportive. She was at the football games. She was at our games. Big wins. She was right there in the locker room with us high-fiving. And, you know, she was involved. She was engaged. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want. You know, you want your chancellor, the head of your university, to be as engaged as the student section. And she showed that. And that commitment led to Pat Richter and Barry Alvarez and Stu Jackson and Coach Sauer. Everyone was in line of what will it take to be successful. And we're going to give you guys the resources and we're going to give you the facilities and we're going to give you the means to have your programs going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And that's important.
So was that, I mean, did you, as a, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior, mm-hmm. did you notice that at the time, or is this something that's sort of reflection, like thinking back on, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I see.
Well,
I see that now.
No, we saw it as it was happening, and I'll tell mm-hmm. you how. Mm-hmm. We saw it in the fact that we drew the first sellout in the field house ever. So that was our crew. When Rashard was signed in that year, 93-94 season, was the first sellout in the field house. The other indication was we used to be able to see, now the way the field house and the Cole Center and then in Camp Randall was made is different. We used to be able to go through the field house into Camp Randall. All right. So we used to be able to walk right out of our locker room area, go across the foyer and go right into Camp Randall and go out into the games. Right. So we practiced at like 9 o'clock and then by kickoff, we go out and go watch the game and we could sit anywhere. Okay. This was my first 2 years. By my third year, we would go out, and the security people were there, and they would be like, guys, we can't let you in without a ticket. They'll let us know that this place is changing drastically. Mm-hmm. And so there was all these signs. And then, shoot, my freshman year, it was like I said, like maybe 35,000 fans in Camp Randall for a football game. And the only reason they were there was to see Troy Vincent. He was the only thing out there that was worth watching and paying a ticket for. Mm-hmm. By 93, it was at least 70,000 people there. And you can tell. And like I said, you had to have a ticket, you know. And so there was so many indications. And we saw how football was so close. And then in the 92-93 season, Stu's first year, we were so close. We went to the NIT, and we lost to Rice in the field house. And I remember us going in the locker room afterwards and crying like babies. But it was funny because we were all quiet at first. And then Tracy Webster just had this outburst of just saying it was his fault and he was sorry. And we just all lost it. And we just had a locker room full of grown men crying and just sobbing all over the place. But that pain led us to the work to make the tournament that next year. And again, adding Rashard was huge, but the commitment we made as a team to get better. Every man made a commitment to get better and to make the team better. And that we saw that. We felt it. It wasn't like we had to make a pact as a group. No one had to say anything. It was just understood that we gotta come back and be better. And we're gonna have another year with Stu's crazy ass and we're gonna know how to deal with him. You know, and we've adjusted with that, and we just got to get the young guys, this talented group of freshmen, Rashard, Donnell Hoskins, Jaleel Roberts. We got to get that group on point with us because they can help us. And we were ready. We were ready to make that run. And when that happened, it was phenomenal. So you saw that happen, and then you saw the Rose Bowl, and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Troy, to be honest with you, as freshmen on this lakeshore, we talked about that in 1990. Barry's first recruiting class, my freshman class, you know, the next class that came after, that was the conversation with football and basketball that we're going to go to Rose Bowls and we're going to the NCAA tournament. This was we felt this. We believed it. It wasn't like we came here to just let it is like status quo. We all came in saying, we're taking this thing to the next stage. You know, and that was understood. And if anything, and if we didn't do that, it was a letdown. So that was the mentality we had. It wasn't like we came in here thinking, oh, yeah, you know, we're already there. We've arrived. No, we knew we could make this program better. There's nowhere to go but up. Mm-hmm. And it was our responsibility to take it to that next level.
Maybe one more thing, and then I want to make sure you get out of here on time.
Okay.
So first couple years. How did you spend your summers? Did you go back?
I spent them all up here. Okay. I took classes, and that's what helped me graduate, to be honest with you. Excuse me, taking those classes in the summer. But, you know, it also, missing that first summer that I wish I would have been in when I graduated from high school, I wish I'd have done it. So I made it a point to stay up here each summer. But now I did go home the summer of 93, like we mentioned, how we wanted to get better. I needed to go back to Chicago and kind of get my swagger back a little bit. To say I played in the pro-am, I worked at a landmark Ford in Niles, Illinois, and the stipulation with that was there was a Leaning Tower YMCA right next door, and so in my lunch break the owner would let me go over there and go and work and shoot and play. But what wound up happening was both owners. The guys that worked in the garage and the porters were all come over and we wound up playing pickup games. And they helped me get better. Now, it were physical games. Like, they beat me up. But it made me better. And it made me tougher. So, it was good. And I appreciated that summer. That was the only summer that I went home while I was here. Because I just needed to just – I felt like I needed to get back to Chicago and get my Chicago toughness back. And it worked out really well. Plus, I bought a car, so it worked out even better. I came back with my first vehicle, a 1985 Mercury Topaz. I'll never forget it.
Well, Coach, I want to let you go this time because I know you have an appointment.
Okay.
And we'll talk We'll talk more again, though.
All right. Are you free tomorrow? You want to finish it tomorrow?
Yeah, let me stop this. Let me take a look at the... Okay. This concludes the first oral history with Howard Moore. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the follow-up interview with Howard Moore. Today, we're actually here at the Cole Center inside the men's basketball offices. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives. So, Coach, like we did last time, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yep. Howard Moore. M-O-O-R-E.
Okay, it's going to pick you up just fine. I'm actually going to turn it down a little bit so you can talk at your normal voice.
Okay.
So the one thing I forgot to ask about those first couple years here is, do you have memories of the first time you actually got on the floor?
Oh. the first time I can remember was our red-white scrimmage, which is a... kind of a traditional, you know, inner squad introduction to the, you know, university of this year's team. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just getting out there for that was great. And the thing I remember my freshman year was having a couple of dunks that really, you know, got my juice going in the student section, got a little fired up. And the thing I used to do when I was a freshman, anytime I would get a rebound or dunk, I would yell at the student section. So it kind of made me stand out a little bit. And, you know, it showed I had a little character. Mm-hmm. So the Bleacher Creatures at the time was the name of our student section. And and they really loved that. And, you know, that was a great memory just from that, you know. And, yeah, obviously I redshirted that year, so.
Right.
Didn't get, you know, play that season, but just being out there for that red-white scrimmage and getting a couple of dunks and getting the crowd going, it was like addiction. I was like, I got to have more of this.
Right,
I got to have more.
Yep.
And that was just the beginning of something that I knew was going to be special. So, but the actual, my first time getting on the floor, my redshirt freshman year, so my second year, if I remember right, we played like Coastal Carolina, somebody like that, and I got off the bench and had a couple points. I think a dunk in that game, and you know, just you know, remember just feeling like, hey, this is going to be fun. I love this place, and you know, and it was always about my teammates. So I always got fired up more about my teammates scoring and playing well than myself.
Okay. So you said last time that your nickname was Dunk.
Duck.
Duck.
Yeah, so like the comic book Howard the Duck.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
So that I misheard you. I thought you said it was Dunk, and I figured it was Dunk because you liked to dunk.
Yeah, Duck.
Okay. Yeah. So the follow-up to what you just said, we talked about the field house last time.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the students sit at the field house? I never got to see
it. Yeah, it was, so I'm trying to think now. It's the south end zone of the field house. Right behind where the band was. So it's similar to what we have now. So it was the south end zone right by the visitor's bench.
Okay.
And the benches were, what is that, east? I think east of the field house, on the east side of the field house. So, you know, it was, they were right there and they were loud. They were loud. And they used to give the opposing teams a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Especially when someone would foul out, you know. And they
Is that the same thing they do here?
Yes.
The left, right,
left, yeah, right? This, okay. Yeah. But I'm just telling you, everything was just magnified in that place. Cause it was just so intimate.
Sure.
You know.
Can we talk about your thoughts when you heard about the coaching change? Because you said that happened.
Yeah, after my second year, when Coach Yoder was told that he was let go, I remember getting the news and kind of being surprised, but not surprised, because you just, like I mentioned before, you felt the change that was happening on campus. And, you know, and the business side of it, when you have a coach has been there for a long time and kind of run out of time, but he's got good young talent, that's usually when administrations make changes.
Mm-hmm.
Because now that new coach is going to have that young talent to develop and blossom and give them a chance to, you know, reach their potential. So, you know, it's kind of the writing on the wall for Coach Yoder. You know, we felt bad, you know, that we didn't achieve more to help him have more time, but I think that was out of our hands. And so you go from, as a player, you know, you go from, you know, the sadness of losing your coach that brought you there to, oh, wow, so who are they going to hire now, you know? Mm-hmm. And I can remember, obviously, we didn't have social media. We didn't have, you know, internet, you know, all of those things. But what you had was, you know, just the speculation in the newspapers. So I remember every day there was speculations about NBA guys and college guys like Rick Majerus, you know, and I remember some of the names, you know, unbelievable names. They'd be like, really? They'd be interested in coming to Wisconsin? And so, you know, when it all came down to it, they hired Stu Jackson in April of 92. And I remember when he came in for his first meeting with the team, and I was like, wow, you know. I remember watching him coaching on the sideline with the Knicks. And the thing that was just so impressive was just how confident he was, you know. And I'll be honest, as an African-American, to see another strong, articulate, you know, ambitious African-American like myself, it was impactful. Mm-hmm. And I've told him a lot of times that, you know, he made a huge impression on me as a young person, and which led to me being a coach. Mm-hmm. And you know, really gave me a lot of inspiration to do what I'm doing now. So yeah, so when Stu came in, there was a whole new mentality, a whole new approach mm-hmm. to doing things. And him and his staff with Stan Van Gundy, you know, Ray McCallum was a holdover from the old staff. Sean Miller, who's now at Arizona, was an assistant. Mm-hmm. That was his first coaching job. Hmm. Yeah, yeah. So it was a great staff.
Wow,
we had a great staff.
Is that, this has nothing to do with the oral history? Is that the same McCallum that the McCallum that plays for Portland? Is there any relation?
No, that's McCollum. That's McCollum. Okay. Yeah, but Ray McCallum used to coach at Detroit, and he had a son. Ray McCallum that played for Sacramento Kings and played in the NBA for a little bit.
Okay.
But
that's why that name sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Great. You mentioned the fact of being able to see another African-American in a leadership role.
Right.
And you talked about how people here embraced you, but I'm wondering, coming from Chicago, mm-hmm. A far more ethnically diverse place than mm-hmm. Madison, mm-hmm. If there were issues for you as a, you know, a young student of color, mm-hmm. not having a lot of people who are also people of color here in town. Yeah.
Well, I think it's through a different lens when you're an athlete, you know, because you're already put into a, you know, kind of a limelight. And so, you know, when you come in as an athlete, it's different from being just a, you know, regular student. People know who you are for the most part. They know where you're from. They know your story. Mm-hmm. So when you're coming in through that, the lens that reflects on you is a little bit different. So my story could be totally different from someone that just came from Milwaukee just to study journalism.
Right.
You know, but I thought that, you know, my time here was pretty good. I didn't have any issues with anyone on or off campus. I always had a personality that was outgoing, mm-hmm. so I never had problems making friends, whether it was in the dorms or going to class or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just never had any issues,
okay.
you know. So my time was pretty positive. I didn't, you know, there was times where we marched and, you know, we made a fuss, you know, like mm-hmm. when the Rodney King verdict went out. That mm-hmm. was my sophomore year. Mm-hmm. We marched from Library Mall to City Hall. And I was one of the speakers during that that time. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty active socially, you know, as far as just on social media issues and things mm-hmm. like that. My teammates called me Malcolm Farrakhan because I was so outspoken, you know, about certain things. But I just, you know, it's like anything else. Yeah, I had a lot of pride in, you know, my culture. And when things, you know, happened that, you know, upset me, you know, I always, you know, found a way to do it in a way that didn't disrupt, you know, too much, mm-hmm. but made it known that I didn't appreciate this. Mm-hmm. And I didn't hide those feelings. And I always had coaches that stood behind me while I did those things. Kind of like Nigel Hayes, in a way. And that's why I was able to use my background and my past to help mentor him. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he had a different platform with social media. He could, you know, approach these differently. I don't know if I would have been in his shoes, if I would have been the same way. But I didn't have that outlet. So we showed our protests in different ways, mm-hmm. which, you know, it, being a child of, you know, someone from the 60s, that's the platform that we chose. Mm-hmm. Now it's a whole another dynamic where, you know, you have another platform to present your case, and they go about things differently. Mm-hmm. So, but I think it's still the same issues sometimes. Yeah, sometimes the same, you know, same problems.
Mm-hmm. So, so when we finished up last time, you went back to Chicago in the summer, mm-hmm. Worked at the dealership.
Yeah.
So then that mean, does that mean you came back, was that your third year here, but second year with eligibility?
That was in 93, so that was going into my fourth year.
Okay.
Yep, going into my fourth year, my third year of eligibility.
So junior in terms of basketball, but fourth year.
Okay. Yep, and that was the year we went to the tournament. So that was 93, 94, is that season there. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that was that Stu's first?
That was his second year.
Second year,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so maybe to back up a year then, because I think you talked a little bit about the NIT.
Yeah, that previous the 92, year. Yeah, when we lost to Rice.
Yeah. So what was some of the differences you started to see with Coach Yoder as, okay. as a player,
yeah.
Coach Yoder as coach, and Coach Jackson?
Well, you know, the thing that when Coach Yoder, his last year, he had Tracy Webster. So remember when I talked about the year before when we went to the NIT with those veteran guys, mm-hmm. we didn't have a point guard. So now, fast forward to 91, 92, we had a point guard, and we were young. So without the bulk of talent, mm-hmm. you have a talented point guard that was dynamic, that could score, that could pass, you know, do a lot of things that way. But we were just so young. So Michael Finley was a true freshman. You know, some of the other guys that were playing didn't play a lot before because those other guys mm-hmm. were there. Mm-hmm. So they had new roles. One of our top players, Carlton McGee, was often hurt. So that was a dynamic with that year, which was Yoder's last year. So we didn't have a great season. So now he's let go, and now you bring in Stu Jackson. Well, now he's got Tracy and Michael with a year under their belt of playing together. You know, everyone else a year of playing that didn't play much before, and now it's a different group and a good core of players that allowed us to have a little bit more success. And like I said, when administrations make changes like that, it's usually strategic in the fact that there's a good core of young talent that you can help groom, and if you add more pieces to it, then they'll be successful. So that's kind of what happened with us with that those next 2 years with mm-hmm. Stu.
Okay. And we mentioned this earlier, but that year then, that first year, Stu, culminated with an NIT bid.
Right.
And so that was your first.
That was my, yeah.
Your first, you know, playoff experience.
Yes. Well, actually, yeah, it was when I was eligible.
Well, yeah, I mean, Richard right. went NIT too. Yeah. First where you could actually be on the court.
Exactly.
So you said that game with Rice was here.
Yes, at the field house, yeah.
I think we talked about this on the record, but it's got to be tough losing a first round game on your own court. The
yeah,
NCAA
to
is
a,
always neutral.
To a lesser team, because Rice isn't a high major program. Mm-hmm. Not even a program that's known for basketball. And they came in here and they beat us. Now, they had a transfer from Northwestern that was from Houston originally. And he transferred back home to Rice. And he had a big hand in beating us. And so that dynamic was the difference. And we were just trying to learn how to win at the time. So, you know, tough timing, tough matchup, all of those things. You know, no excuses, we lost.
Right.
But, again, like I mentioned, it fed us. It gave us the motivation. It gave us the camaraderie to come back the next year and take this thing to the next step, which mm-hmm. was the NCAA tournament.
Mm-hmm. So that year, too, that – you talked about some academic issues that you'd had
mm-hmm.
your first couple years.
Yes,
so
my first two, yeah.
And then regular freshman.
Yeah.
How was that? Do you have memories of that third year sort of academically?
Yeah. Just, you know, I wound up declaring Afro-American Studies as my major. Having a better understanding of, you know, time management, you know, taking the classes that I was more interested in, mm-hmm. Making sure my class load wasn't overwhelming. And then just having a little bit of confidence in who I was as a student. And so being here for a couple of years, turning that corner as far as maturity and understanding of what I wanted to study and what direction I wanted to go in, all that came together at one point. And that happened to be during that my third year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and then the, like I mentioned, is the you know, Stu Jackson coming in, a new dynamic, a clean slate, mm-hmm. to, you know, sort of say, just to give me the, you know, kind of a new perspective. And that really helped, you know, during that time.
And then you also, you said you lived on campus the first couple, you're in the dorms, mm-hmm. the first couple of years.
Yeah.
So you also, I'm assuming, moved
off
campus.
I moved off, yeah.
Where was your off-campus housing?
The first apartment I lived on was on Marion Street. And it was right across the street from the then Howard Johnson, which is right over here. Mm-hmm. And it was a small apartment with a non-student athlete. Just a friend that I had developed a friendship with here. He's from Madison. A guy named Cam Woodard. And Cam and I were good friends. My high school classmate and teammate came up here to UW as well. He didn't play basketball, but he came up here to go to school. He wound up having to drop out because of the financial burden, mm-hmm. on his family. So when he was moving out of the apartment, because I used to go over there all the time, they both were like, hey, why don't you take over the lease and just move in? And so I wound up taking his apartment, and that's how I got off campus.
Okay.
And it worked out well because even though I love my teammates, it was good to just kind of get away a little bit because you're with them so much.
Right.
And so I wound up moving, you know, in an apartment with, you know, non-athletes, but they were really good students. And that was the other – and Cam was a good student. And so that was another reason for me to kind of move in with him because he had good study habits. He had – good discipline, you know, for those things. So that gave me another reason why I say, hey, you know what, I'm going to move in with him. And he'll be a good example for me moving forward.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So I guess I'll just ask this now in general since we're sort of on academics.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout your time here at UW-Madison, this is a broad question, but either sort of classes that stood out or professors who stood out?
Well, one class that stood out was a jazz class that I took, Black Ensemble, with Richard Davis. And Richard Davis is a jazz legend. I don't know if you're familiar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and Richard was stern. He was tough. He took no shit. I remember our first day of class, one of the students came late, and Richard stopped the class and cursed this guy out for like 10 minutes straight. And no one else came late for class moving forward. But it was, that was just, that was one of those classes. Because I was always a fan of jazz, I love hip hop music. And hip hop, you know, would use samples of jazz musicians and jazz music. Mm-hmm. So when you heard the originals, it made me even more interested to see, you know, man, so if they sample this, what else did they sample? And who are the artists?
Right.
So you start learning more about Miles Davis and, you know, Lionel Hampton and, you know, Dizzy Gillespie and, you know, Art Blakey, you know, and the people that, you know, helped form jazz music, you know, and it just gave me a whole new perspective on music. And Richard was a big part of that. So taking his class, Craig Werner, who was my mentor, and I love Craig to death. As an Afro-American studies major, Craig was just a huge influence on me. You know, this goofy-looking white dude from Denver, Colorado, is teaching Afro-American studies to a predominantly white, you know, student section, student population. And he really, he did a good job of utilizing the black athletes that were in his class, and just the black students, period. But it was mostly us athletes because we just loved his classes. And drawing off of our relation, our perspective and our, you know, past and experiences, good and bad, you know. And I also take a lot of pride in the fact that we started the first hip-hop class here at UW with Craig. And now it's a normal thing, mm-hmm. but we were the first class to ask for it. We demanded it, and we were the first one to have it. And that first class was electric with the conversation, the debates, the, you know, all of the things that goes with a class that has that type of, you know, content and perspective, because at that time we had students from California, from the East Coast, from the Midwest, from the South, and everyone was just talking about how hip hop affected them and who were the best artists and who was the top five and this and that, mm-hmm. and who stunk and, you know, all of those things. So,
and that was good. Probably an opportunity too to compare notes in an era where you can't just go onto the internet.
No.
Like,
no.
You know, there were probably groups that some aspect of some classmate had heard of that you probably never heard of, or maybe just heard of a little bit.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, being able to bring that together into a class would have been a great setting. Oh,
phenomenal. No, I remember those first classes were great. No, we had a good time.
Did Craig incorporate music into his into his class?
Well, even before, so you had the black music class, which was very popular. It was, I think, it's Afro 231. And it talked about music from slavery to today. Mm-hmm. So it just showed how, like obviously gospel was a big part of, you know, the start, you know, with slavery, mm-hmm. and how there was, you know, songs like, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and, you know, the evolution of black music and how it really was American music, because it influenced so many other aspects of the pop culture. And then obviously how jazz influenced this, and R&B and disco, and so you go into every genre of music and how it all evolved, and how rock and roll was really a black music form, and so, you know, just learning all of those things, it just, you know, it brings it all to perspective. So, and Craig did a great job of doing that. So you show up for the first day of class, you hear James Brown blasting "Say It Loud," "I'm Black and I'm Proud," you know, and people walking down the hall like, "What class is this?" You know, and all of our classes were mostly in humanities buildings, so it was kind of fun. Mm. Yeah,
yeah, that's another building that's not easy to get around.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so we're past the NIT year, so now we're in the year. It's Coach Jackson's second year.
Yes.
So, as an athlete, you're a junior. Your fourth year here.
Mm-hmm.
When did you know that this could be the year that you actually got the tournament bid?
Well, it's funny because if I'm correct, we started that season 11-0, so we got off to an unbelievable start to the season. Now the only sad part is that our first loss was a 30-point blowout at Minnesota on ESPN. So we got a little rude awakening about what was reality after we had such a torrid start to the season. It was such a rude awakening to have in conference play. But it kind of brought us back to earth and made us realize that, you know, hey, we gotta get better. You know, we haven't arrived yet. Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't done anything. We haven't won any awards. When you're 11-0, you haven't won anything. And so we had to really just kind of bring it back to perspective that, you know, we still got a lot of work to do and we got to keep getting better. And but that was an indication, that 11-0 run was an indication that things were turning and we were on the right path.
Mm-hmm. And then that was Rashard Griffin's freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know him in Chicago?
Yeah, we played against each other in high school.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a point guard,
mm-hmm.
which obviously a team needs, but now you also have
the center,
a post presence.
Yes, yes. With a dynamic wing and Michael Finley, and it was, you just put whatever role players like myself around those guys, and you make it, you know, it doesn't matter. You just, you know, that was the key though. We knew that, you know, the Chiefs were Mike and Tracy, okay? And then we had this dynamic freshman big guy that was, you know, so confident in who he was as a player that he played above his years. But he was smart enough to understand how to play off of those other guys. And they were smart enough to understand that they needed him inside. But then you had guys like myself, Andy Kilbride, and Brian Kelly, and Jeff Peterson, and, you know, guys that were, you know, that we bought into our roles and understood what those roles were and how important they were to play off of those other three, you know, the big three. Mm-hmm. That's what made us good. That was our synergy. And it really gave us the opportunity to overcome some things and to probably, you know, beat people that we shouldn't have beaten. But our style of play was totally different. I mean, we were up and down. We were up-tempo. We were pressing. you know, trying to, you know, dictate tempo and do those things. So it was a totally different look of Wisconsin basketball.
Yeah.
You know, but we, like, you know, but remember now, Stu Jackson comes from a Rick Pitino family tree. So Rick Pitino was in that style of pressing and running and jumping and all those things. So that's what he brought to Wisconsin, and we had the athletes to play that way.
And was that another change from
Yoder.
Coach Yoder?
Yes,
Coach Jackson?
Big time. Our style of play was totally different. Where, you know, when I mentioned those guys that played, like the Willie Sims, the Patrick Tompkins, the Tim Locums, they wanted to play that way, but we weren't built that for that. And Yoder understood that, and that's what a good coach understands. Like, I got to play with the personnel that I'm given. We didn't have the personnel to play that way. But now you got a Tracy Webster who can push the ball and make plays, a Michael Finley who's running the wings, Andy Kilbride running the wings, you know, forwards that were like Greyhounds and myself and guys like that, and then a big guy that can clean it all up, you know, that you have that ability to play that way. So, you know, and then defensively we were pretty good. We really bought into the defense.
And then it also sounds like that year, partially because of Rashard and partially because probably just the what the folks had seen the previous year, you actually started getting more people at the field house?
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, when people saw how good Tracy and Michael were, and then you add a player that UW usually, let's be honest, at the time, don't get a Rashard Griffith. I mean, Donald's All-American that can pick any school in the country, and he picked Wisconsin. But it shows a lot of – it shows that he was smart enough to evaluate and say, yeah, I could go to Michigan, I could go to Georgetown, I can go to those other schools that have the traditional big guys, and they win all the time. But why don't I make a mark for myself at a Wisconsin and do something that hadn't been done before? Or I haven't done it in a long time. And that was his thinking, which was smart. You know, he saw that we had pieces here that, you know, that was important. You know, he had the guards. He had the players there around him. He was the piece that we needed. And so he knew he was going to walk into a starting spot, and he was going to be a, you know, pretty central figure in what we were trying to build. So it was a smart move.
So I forgot to look at the schedule that year. How did you all do in the Big Ten tournament?
Well, we didn't have a Big Ten tournament at the time. It was just regular season.
Regular
so
season,
you played
18 right,
games.
Right.
But this is to let you know how strong the Big Ten was back then. Like, we won 8 games in the Big Ten. So we were 8-10. So we were below 500 in Big Ten and still made the NCAA tournament. So that lets you know how respected the Big Ten has always been. And then even without that Big Ten tournament, we still got 7 teams in that year, which is one of the most we've ever gotten in. And obviously, we were probably that 7th team. But at the same time, 8 wins got us in the tournament.
So, you know, it's now, Selection Sunday's now a big deal.
Yeah. It's still yeah. back then, too.
I so mean, were you all gathered together?
At Stu Jackson's house. Yeah, yeah.
And was it on the TV? Or
yes.
Okay.
So we were all in his living room, and his wife, Janet, you know, they had, you know, food all over the place and pizza and popcorn and pizza, pretzels, everything. And we're all waiting and we're watching the TV. But then Stu had to go in the back, and I guess he was on the phone with Dick Vitale. So he heard that we were in before we did. But then it was not that – it was like just a few minutes before. But when we saw Wisconsin on the screen, like the euphoria in that room, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, for you all, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
This was a team that hadn't been in the NCAAs.
In 47 years.
Right?
1947 was the last time, so it was 47 years since we've been in the tournament.
So I bet this place was, in general, campus was a little happy.
Oh, yeah. Because remember now, just a few months earlier, we just won the Rose Bowl.
That's true.
So
right.
We had that euphoria going on. Now, they didn't tear up State Street like they did the Rose Bowl win, you know, unfortunately. But, you know, people were still excited. And, you know, and it was just a good energy on campus. You know, and again, coming from that Rose Bowl win, it was just the perfect, you know, follow-up. Was us going to the NCAA tournament and then winning a game, not just going, but winning a game, and it was just a great time. But you can tell, like I mentioned before, now Troy, you can tell that there was a change of coming, you know, and this was going to become the norm. Like we weren't going back. You can tell it was there was a sense of purpose. You know, even though Donna had left by this time, and I think David Wiley took over after that, it was set in motion. Everything was set in motion. And you can just tell that this was a change that was going to affect us for years to come. And, you know, and again, you take pride in that, you know. I mean, I still have, you know, some of the memorabilia from that time.
Yeah, I want to, you know. I want to make sure I get a picture of that ball.
And that's the 92 team right there. That's Stu's first year right there with all those signatures. You know, and that's Sean Miller right there.
Right.
You know, so you got all of those stuff, all those things in place. And, you know, like I said, the memorabilia from that time, you know, even still got the tickets with the little medals they put for us. They did that for us just because it was just important. You know, that people understood that was a special time in Wisconsin basketball history.
Did you get on the court either of those games?
No, I didn't. I wasn't good enough.
Okay.
I didn't.
But still, it's got to be just, being sitting there with your teammates at an NCAA tournament.
Ogden, Utah.
Oh, right.
I'll never forget it.
Weber State.
Yep. And Syracuse was there. Green Bay was there. And it was funny because they played Jason Kidd's Cal team.
Right.
And we were sitting in the stands just laughing ourselves to death because, you know, Jason Kidd and who was his teammate? He played in the NBA too.
Yeah, there was another one.
I can't think of his name right now, but they were just shooting jump shots. They couldn't get to the rim. They couldn't, you know, with that pack line defense, the way Coach teaches it, they couldn't get in the paint. And so Jason Kidd, who's never been known as a jump shooter, was just settling for jump shots. And we're just sitting in the stands just like, you're falling right into their hands. Mm-hmm. And then that was the big upset of that tournament in our region.
Right.
Green Bay beat Cal. Right. Jason Kidd's Cal.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, I need to check the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got almost a quarter too.
Yeah, I'm going to have to head here in a second.
Okay.
So, we may have to try to finish up with one more of these at some point.
That's fine.
I apologize.
No, it's okay.
But maybe we can wrap up this time with, you get done with that, so your fourth year academically, but your third year tournament bid. I don't know the chronology. When did Coach Jackson then?
That summer. Okay. So the summer of 94, actually during his camps.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was working his camp that summer. So summer of 94, most of my teammates had left and went home, but I was working camp. And there was this buzz going around that Stu was going back to the NBA from the coaches that were working the camp, you know. And so Stu showed up and grabbed me, and we went up into the stands in the field house during camp. And he said, H, you know, you always call me H. H, you know, I gotta tell you guys something, and, you know, it's going to be tough, but, you know, I got one of the best opportunities that I could ever receive, and I'm going to have an opportunity to kind of start an NBA franchise from the ground up. And it's an opportunity that's going to be great for my family, and I can't turn it down, and just wanted to know what you thought. And I remember it because now showing that I'm getting older and showing my maturity a little bit, I just told him, I said, Coach, you know, obviously you've done great things here in just two short years. And we love what you've brought and how you've helped us. And there's no way in the world we can be mad at you for, you know, chasing your dream and, you know, and having this opportunity. You can't turn it down. There's no way. Mm-hmm. I told him, I said, we'd be sad and we'd miss you, but, you know, this would be a great opportunity. You can't pass it up. So you got our support. I mean, I'm a senior now, fifth year senior, going into the next year. And, you know, I just told him that I know I'm speaking for the team when I say that, you know, we support you, we're behind you. And he was happy to hear that. You can see, I just remember him being relieved that we weren't going to be pissed. And why would you? That's a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. But the thing he asked me was, so I need you guys to go to Pat Richter and just, you know, just tell him you guys would support Stan Van Gundy taking over as head coach. And I'm like, that's a no-brainer. Absolutely. So I remember Michael came back to town, and Andy Kilbride and myself and maybe Chris Conger, who was a senior walk-on, and we all went up to Pat's office and told him we want to support Stan as the next head coach. And Pat, you know, was being gracious, and you know, he appreciated the sentiment and everything, and we'll go through the process and yada yada yada. But Stan was given a 5-year contract, and he was the head coach. And the rest, I guess we'll have to talk about.
Yeah, the rest we'll have to talk about next time.
The next time.
Yeah. But thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, no, my
pleasure.
So this
concludes the second interview with Howard Moore. Okay, this is the third interview with Howard Moore. We're back at Steenbach Library. And my name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So Howard, like we've done in the past, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, Howard Moore, M-O-O-R-E.
Thank you. So when we last left off, it was really your fifth year here, mm-hmm. but your senior year in terms of athletics.
Right.
Your fifth year senior, basically.
Right. Yeah.
The move had been made from Jackson to Coach Van Gundy.
Yep, and Stan got the job.
Yeah, so you said you had been working camps that summer.
Mm-hmm.
That means you stuck around here that summer, is that correct?
Yes, I did. That was one of the summers where I felt like, you know, going into my last year, it only made sense to get some classes in, help towards graduation, so that I could have, you know, an easier, course load my last two semesters. But at the same time, you know, just be up here, make a little money working camps, work out, get prepared for next season, and really put all I could in that summer to get prepared.
I know obviously you were a senior, it was going to be your last
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have discussions with Coach Van Gundy or discussions with you about what your role might be?
Not necessarily. You know, I knew I wanted to get on the court, you know, more than I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to make sure that I controlled that, not the coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, early on it was tough because, you know, they had kind of recruited some other guys, a couple young kids, you know, that they were trying to build up. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of in that, you know, that realm of you got experience, you've been around, you've earned your dues. But they're also trying to build for the future.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I just made it tough every practice, you know, on the coaches to overlook me. And I earned the opportunity to get on the court, and then it led to a starting position my fifth year.
Okay. Do you remember that first start?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, against Northwestern at home.
Okay.
I had 11 points, 8 rebounds, and really set the tone for that game as far as my energy and my enthusiasm and the fact that I had my first start in a Badger uniform in the field house. It was unbelievable and really ignited the team. And we were kind of in a lull. We had a couple of tough losses. The one before, I remember losing at home to Penn State, a team that was okay, that we should have beaten at home,
mm-hmm.
and we just didn't play well enough to beat them. And Coach wanted to inject a little energy, a little bit of enthusiasm to line up, and sure enough, I was ready.
Mm-hmm.
And when he put me in, it worked out well.
Mm-hmm. When I talked to Rashard about this
mm-hmm.
this year, because this was the year after you made the tournament.
Yes.
And he mentioned that, you know, Tracy's graduation and the loss of Tracy was a big impact.
Yeah.
Is that something you agree with?
I do. You know, just that floor general, you know, someone that galvanized the team, you know, in every aspect, on and off the court. He was our quarterback, and he kept everyone happy for a certain extent as far as making sure Mike got his shots, Rashard got his touches, you know, knew how to really balance that out from a leadership standpoint, from a relationship standpoint. You know, it was really good to see how Tracy evolved as a player and as a leader. And when we lost him, you know, that was kind of the heart and soul that left the team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he graduated.
So, first start was against Northwestern. We have that sort of iconic picture of Mike Finley.
That was the game. Yeah, that's the game.
And you're
trailing.
I mean, like, if we end up showing that picture someday, you're the first.
I'm the
you're
first.
The first Badger that you see.
Yeah.
If, when you start looking past.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you all know that? I'm sure you did, but I'm gonna ask anyway. That Michael Finley was, you know, destined for.
Yes, yes. I mean, he could have probably left after his sophomore year, definitely after his junior year, but he stayed and kept getting better. You know, it was a different time then, you know, where it wasn't the the quick goal of I want to go to the NBA. It was, am I good enough? Even for players of his caliber, still question if they were good enough to play and go. Mm-hmm. And for him to be a four-year player is amazing, you know, because he easily could have went earlier. But he needed to get stronger. He needed to work on his handle, work on his shot, be more consistent. And it actually paid off for him to do those things.
So that season ended up not being an NCAA tournament.
No.
But I'm assuming there was still at least a little bit of excitement for you, the final game, seeing the last game for seniors.
Yeah, we lost that game, though. I remember we lost to Indiana at home senior night. And I had never beaten Indiana in my five years. In 5 years, never beat Indiana. And that was a tough pill to swallow, especially having them on senior night. And we played them in a really tough game, both at their place and at ours. I mean, we played well enough to win. Mm-hmm. And we just weren't there. You know, we just didn't have the aura that Indiana has, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That they feel like we should beat in Wisconsin at that time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we've owned them the past, you know, 12, 15 years. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it was a different time then. And we just couldn't get over that hump with Indiana. So it was tough to say you lost home, you know, senior night. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, I thought we had a great 4 year career, you know, 5 years for me, mm-hmm. and there was a lot to celebrate, you know, on top of the other things that happened.
Mm-hmm. And you were lined up to graduate the end of that semester.
Yes,
correct?
I graduated in the spring. Okay. Yep, so it worked out well.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask a few more questions now to get us to today.
Okay.
So what, as you graduated and you finished your college career, mm-hmm. what was your next? What were you thinking your next steps were?
Well, I wanted to see if I could continue playing. You know, I love to play. I wanted to see if I can continue to get better. You know, and so I tried to go over to Europe, and I went over to Czech Republic on a tour team with a bunch of folks from mostly Milwaukee. They went on a tour, and we went over there for a couple weeks, and I was hoping to latch on with a team over there, and it didn't pan out. You know, I can't wind up coming back home. And when I came back home, but at least I had my degree. So my biggest thing was just, hey, you come home and, you know, you get a job. So I came back to Madison, ironically, and I worked for the ticket office, and then I worked for M&I Bank here in town, and I was in a management trainee program. Didn't like banking, you know, and then there was an opportunity for me to go back to Chicago. There was a former player, Tom Mulaski, who was a district manager at a company called OEI Business Forms in Itasca, Illinois, right outside of Chicago by Skokie. And I wound up talking to him at our alumni game, alumni weekend, and we talked about me maybe moving back and working in sales. So he offered me a job, and I went back to Chicago. So I was there working for him at OEI. Had a lot of fun working there. And being in sales was good because I'm a personable, you know, type of person that's outgoing and mm-hmm. don't mind building relationships and things of that nature. And it's funny how it led to me being a recruiter, you know, because of it's all relationship, you know, driven. Mm-hmm. And so working where Tom was great, working at OEI, being back home, you know, I realized how being in Chicago as an adult was different from being there as a kid. So I enjoyed the, you know, what downtown Chicago had to offer and, you know, dating and all that stuff. It was a lot of fun for a guy in his early 20s, you know, making a little money and trying to do some things, you know, to become a grown man, really, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But I missed basketball, and so I played in probably every pro-am in Chicago that was available every night of the week. And then I got the bug for coaching. You know, my high school coach, I let him know I was back in town, and he asked me to come by and help out a little bit, and it went from me just popping in and visiting and jumping in a couple of drills to actually running practice, you know, and actually being on the bench for games. Mm-hmm. So I always tell my coach he tricked me into getting into coaching because it was like it started as, yeah, come by and talk to the kids, come and practice with us to run that play that we used to run. And, you know, it just a gradual in giving me a little bit more rope to mm-hmm. work with and mm-hmm. wound up me getting into coaching. And then he grabbed me and pulled me in the office one day and was like, you know what, you got a really good feel for this. The kids love you. You really do a good job of, you know, explaining and teaching. You should think about getting the coaching full time. And he said, high school's not going to pay you much, you know, but if you can get into college, that would be, pretty lucrative for you if you can make it work. Mm-hmm. And I was single, married, not married, no kids. It was, if I was going to do it, I was going to do it then.
Right.
So I was about 27 at the time and, decided to go volunteer at the University of Chicago. And that's where my college coaching career began. And that was in 1997.
And then the online profile that Athletics has for mm-hmm. You had a few different coaching gigs before you got the gig back, the first time back
right,
here.
Right. So I was at Chicago until 99. Then I was at Bradley University from 99 to 2003. Then I was at Ball State just 1 year, 2003-2004. Then I was at Loyola Chicago from 04 to 05. And then Bo hired me in 05.
Okay.
And I was here till 2010.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if you could encapsulate that time period, what things were you learning about yourself and about being a coach that you were able to then, apply once you came back?
Really identifying who I was as a coach, being so young and trying to figure it all out. I was fortunate to be with good people that taught me the good principles of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness I wasn't with guys that cut corners and taught you how to, do it the wrong way. So Jim Molinari is a guy that recruited me to Northern Illinois, and I turned him down to go to Wisconsin, and he winds up hiring me at Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
And then at Bradley, my whole life changed down in Peoria. I was down there with him for 3 years, and I was a holdover with Jimmy Less when he took over in 2003. Mm-hmm. So learned what to do and what not to do at Bradley, to be honest with you. But it was tough. It was times when I was like, I don't want to do this, because those guys, especially Mo, Molinari was very hard on me. But he knew he had to help me get better. And that was how he got me better. Unless, a person who never coached college basketball, was never a head coach, he's a great player at Bradley, had enough, clout with the people that mattered there, mm-hmm. where he was able to get the job. And a lot of people like myself that just kind of worked their way up and paid their dues kind of, frowned up when they saw how Les got the job.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a different way. So some of the things he did, the tactics he did, I didn't approve of and I didn't like. So it was easy for me after that year to just say, I'm going to go and do something different. So that's when I went to Ball State, and I worked for Tim Buckley, who was an assistant for us in that 93-94 season here at Wisconsin. So Tracy Webster worked for him at Ball State, and then when Tracy left to go to Purdue, I left Bradley and went to Ball State to replace Tracy at Ball State.
Okay.
And that was good. It was a good learning process for me. Buck was tough. He was tough on me as well. He made me better. But then when I went to Loyola, I felt like I was prepared. After the years I had at Bradley and then going to Ball State and getting my tail kicked by those two coaches, three coaches, I felt like I was ready for Loyola. And so going there with Jim Weitzel, who was a guy that I looked up to and I respected, he came from Lewis, which is a Division II program right outside of Chicago. He felt like Loyola was his dream job, So it kind of would have been cool to see him make that run that they made this offseason, this past season,
Mm-hmm.
Because when we inherited that program, it was not a Division I program. I mean, it was everything but Division I, from facilities to the aesthetics of the program and the facilities. It was very poor. So it was humbling, but we worked and we didn't care. We just made it. We just worked, and the staff was great. We were close. We liked working with each other. We worked long days, long hours, but we really enjoyed it, and that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I expected to be there for a while. That was his first season, so it was all of our first season, and we were just willing to just roll our sleeves up and just try to make it happen. The only thing was, it's funny, when I interviewed with Jim. He asked me, he said, what job would you leave here? Because you've bounced around a little bit here. Where would you, what would you leave here for? And I told him, I said, the only job that I would really want to leave here, because I'm back home, I love working with you and this guy's, I said, was Wisconsin. If Bo Ryan called me, I would leave for Wisconsin. I was honest. And he understood, you know. And unfortunately for him, Bruce Pearl went to the Sweet 16 at Milwaukee. Robbie Jeter got the Milwaukee job when Bruce left for Tennessee. And then Bo called me to come and replace Robbie. So the rest was history. That was less than a year later after he hired me. So, you know, I guess it worked out. But, you know, I don't regret anything. It was to be.
Did you know Bo before?
Yeah, I knew Bo. I didn't know him very – I wasn't very close to him, but I was very close to a couple of his players at Platteville.
Okay.
Especially one of his best players, Ernie Peavy. Ernie would come – we were the same age. And so Ernie would come to Madison and stay with me and work out with us in the field house and – train and get ready for his seasons, you know, here in Madison. So I was really close with Ernie. I called Bo when he got the Milwaukee job in 99. So, you know, we talked and, you know, we had a chance to, you know, get to know each other a little bit. Obviously, we knew of each other because he followed the Badger program. And I remember hearing stories about him when he was an assistant. That wasn't too far away from me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just knew of each other. And then we got to know each other a little bit more. When I went to Chicago, he was at Milwaukee, so I would see him on the road and recruiting, and so we would just kind of pass each other that way. And I would always throw a note in the mail to him just to say hi and just keep my name in his in his ear. Mm-hmm. And I remember Greg Gard told me later that whenever a letter came from me, he'd say, "Hey, got another letter from Howard. You never know." So I guess it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest thing was, you know, just being patient. And when my time came, I was ready. One of the things I remember the most is when Bo brought me in for my quote-unquote interview, you know, because he said it wasn't an interview, it was just a meeting. My wife and I came down. We spent the whole day with him and the staff. We went over to the nitty-gritty and I saw my friend Marsh, who owned it, and he's passed away a few years ago. But, you know, seeing him and seeing some old pictures in the nitty gritty and just reminiscing, it was just a really good visit. Mm-hmm. And Bo pulled me in his office, and Greg grabbed my wife and kind of had her distracted in his office down the hall. And Bo looked at me right in the eyes and said, "Well, just got a question for you. Are you ready to come home? Are you ready to come home to Wisconsin?" And I'm sitting there. And I'm like, I'm getting emotional, and I couldn't answer him. And I'm sitting there, and I'm saying to myself, "You're not gonna cry in front of Bo Ryan." And as the tears started coming down, he just looked at me and said, "I'll take that as a yes." And then he got up and gave me a big hug, and it was great. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he called for Jen and Greg, and you know. That was a special day, you know, to be able to go back. So when I drove back to Chicago, I don't even remember the drive. I mean, I might as well have been floating back to Chicago, knowing that I'm coming back here. And not just that I'm moving up in the coaching ranks, going from mid-major to high major. It was, I was coming home to Wisconsin, and that meant so much to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember just having these big smiles on my face the whole time, just knowing I'm going to work my tail off, and I'm going to do everything I can to help Bo Ryan and make this program better.
Right. So then, what was your role or key aspects of your job?
Recruiting.
Okay.
Recruiting. I mean, I had done scouting and, you know, obviously you get on the court and you coach. But I didn't do a lot of scouts then. I did a lot of recruiting. I was a young guy on the staff and my job was to go get players. And that was fine.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot under Bo. I learned a lot under Greg and Gary Close. And the staff was great to work with. You know, and, you know, but I understood I was the young guy with the least experience. So I just did what I was told and I worked my tail off. You know, I was in my, you know, mid to late 30s, but still had a ton of energy and just ready to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so just, you know, trying to go out and find the best players I could to fit the program and, you know, to be able to recruit guys that led Bo to a Final Four was special to me. Even though I wasn't here to experience that, that was tough. I'll be honest.
Mm-hmm.
It was gratifying to know that I did do my part when I was here, and I really helped Bo and I helped the program.
Mm-hmm.
So,
who was your first?
My first recruit was a kid named Ian Markoff, And he was a 7-footer from San Antonio, but he didn't pan out. He wasn't. It was funny because Bo actually offered him, even though I had him come on campus for a visit. I hadn't seen him play, but Bo had saw some film of him that he brought up here with him. And Bo saw it before I did. So, you know, he was in his office watching it while we were walking around campus. And then we came back, and Bo just offered the kid a scholarship. So I guess I kind of claimed that one, but, you know, I guess, you know, it just worked out weird. And then I recruited a kid named Ryan Evans. I don't know if you remember Ryan. Mm-hmm. Ryan was a good player for us. I recruited Ryan. So he was kind of really theoretically my first because I discovered him. I recruited him, and I got him to come here. You know, and then from there it was recruited Ben Brust, Duye Dukin, George Marshall, who wound up transferring. I'm trying to think.
Did you have
Frank Kaminsky?
Jordan Taylor? Jordan?
No. Greg recruited Jordan. Greg recruited Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
I was mostly Illinois and some other, like Phoenix was, you know, Ryan and Texas. I kind of built relationships with people outside of the Midwest.
That makes sense because, I mean, that's where you were from.
Yeah.
You'd already built relationships at the places that you
grew up. Oh, yeah. At. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So.
So then those teams, so that was like 06 to 09, right? Or was it longer?
When I was.
Your first assistant.
Yes, that was 05 to 2010.
Oh, okay.
So, and then I went to UIC in 2010.
Okay, so those obviously were all tournament teams because we had a string of tournament teams.
19 years.
I know you're primarily a recruiter, but as an assistant coach, which of those teams do you think, I should say, could have gone farther?
Well, you know, the team that stands out the most that I really thought resonated were the Orlando Tucker teams for sure. But the year when Orlando graduated, so Cam Taylor, remember Cam Taylor, the guard?
Mm-hmm.
Him and Orlando and those guys, when they graduated, people thought we were going to be horrible. And we didn't have a clear-cut star, you know. But Brian Butch, Marcus Landry, Michael Flowers – you know, Joe Krabanoff, all those guys, we just were a collection of guys. And there would be different leading scorers almost every game. But we were a very good defensive team, which made us great. And so that team was, you know, we won the Big Ten regular season. We won the Big Ten tournament title. We lost to Steph Curry's Davidson team in the Sweet 16. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that team should have went further. You know, that was tough. When Steph's teams played Georgetown, I was rooting for Georgetown because I knew we could beat Georgetown. I knew that Davidson team was going to be tough for us, you know.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about Frank, but you – so I want to hear the story, though, of what – how you end up getting the job at UIC.
Okay. Well, you know, Jimmy Collins had been at UIC for, you know, numerous years. From 96 to 2010, and he actually retired July 31st. So he left the job in July. Usually a job opens in March or April. And so for a job to open on August 1st is very unconventional. And to be honest, it's very difficult because you're way behind in recruiting. So you missed out on the July period. You missed out on the spring period. There's no honeymoon period. It's just, you're just there and you got to figure it out on the fly. So my first year was difficult, but at the same time, you know, I enjoyed it because I was ahead of my own program. You know, we had so far to go, but obviously we were willing to put in the work to be where we needed to be. You know, I got the job August 20th, and so my press conference was the first day of class, you know, at UIC, which was ridiculous. So I never felt like we were on time. I always felt like we were behind in recruiting and being where we needed to be in competing in our conference. It was a perpetual game of catch-up for me. I couldn't hire the staff that I really wanted to hire because it was so late, and the guys that I preferred they just couldn't leave the jobs they were at because they just would have put their coaches in a bind. Mm-hmm. So I understood that. So I hired a couple high school guys that I knew in Chicago. One guy worked with me at Bradley, another guy that I've known for years. And then I hired another guy who I knew when I was at Ball State. He was known as a really hard recruiter, junior college, prep school, Canada, so he can get me in some doors that I wanted to get into. Because Chicago is such a competitive recruiting market, and I knew I was going to get everybody in Chicago, but I wanted to be able to get into other markets that I can sell Chicago to, and they would understand what that was about. So that was the route that we went. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first year was rough. The only highlight of that year was we beat Illinois. That was ranked 12th in the country, and we beat them at the United Center with a sea of orange all around the place and a little pocket of red and red and blue of UIC. And that was a special day, you know. And it was a day where, you know, people probably thought we were going to lose by 50, and Illinois did too, because they had this whole day lined up. You know, they were going to – the game was at like 11 a.m., so they were going to kick our butt by 50, go do like a meal downtown, like Lowry's or something, and then come to the Bulls game that night. Well, obviously we changed the whole itinerary that day. That was Bruce Weber's team who coached that team. And I had a lot of respect for Bruce. But I figured I knew their teams pretty well. We put in a 1-3-1 zone that really messed with him and screwed with him. He thought we were going to play all man-to-man like Bo Ryan does. And like we really did for the most part all season until we threw that 1-3-1 in, and it really screwed with him and gave us a chance. But the tempo, the pace, the possessions, everything was in our favor. And our guys played well, especially by one player that only had that first year. It was Robo Krebs. And Robo came out just knocking down shots and just took that team with him. So it was fun to watch. It was fun to be a part of. Mm-hmm. And the UIC faithful was very happy that day. Mm-hmm. And we haven't beat Illinois since then. So, and I don't even think they're going to play them at the United Center anymore. And that's over. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a tough year. I think we only won like 7 games, including that Illinois game. But I was able to go and try to get some players and try to build it. And by my third year, I had a team that I really liked. We were, you know, had some veterans, you know, guys that were seniors. I had 4 seniors that I thought were good. One of them was a 5th-year senior, a big kid that I knew for years, and he wanted to come back home and, you know, finish his career in Chicago. So he was a 5th-year transfer named Josh Criddle. And he was the difference. He was just like Rashard was for us here. Mm-hmm. He was the Rashard for me at UIC. Mm-hmm. And was just a terror inside. And, you know, I told him I was going to get him the touches and give him the ball, and he was going to be able to just, you know, help us win games. Mm-hmm. And we had players around him that helped. So we ran the swing, and we ran some specials, and we did, you know, we guarded. We were a really good defensive team. And I felt that was a team that really just allowed me to just coach the way I wanted to, play some of the things I wanted to play. And I really enjoyed coaching that year because I felt like I had all my pieces. The years before, I felt like I was going to a gunfight with a butter knife, you know. And that's when Butler was in the league, you know, mm-hmm. with Brad Stevens. And, mm-hmm. you know, they were Final Four. It was the Final Four teams. And we just weren't equipped to beat those type of teams at that time. And so I felt like that year, that third year, we were where we needed to be. And that was a fun group to coach. But then I told my administration, like, hey, we're going to be young again next year. But I got an extension, I got a raise, and all that good stuff. And I told my staff, act like we didn't get this extension. You know, because you never know. And I was prophetic, unfortunately. Right. And the next year, we went on a 16-game losing streak. Injuries and anything bad that can happen in a season happened. And so that put the administration in a position where they were like, yeah, we'll give them a vote of confidence and let them come in. Whenever they come out publicly and say we stand behind them and we're going to give them another year, that's always a death sentence. And so the next year I would have had to just go crazy as far as wins. We had to win about 30 games for me to save my job. So I knew I was in trouble. As the year went on, we were hurt some more. Some players panned out that I brought in, some didn't. We were just scrambling until once the injuries and things and all the BS kind of settled down, and I had that good core of good kids, good character kids.
we wound up finishing the season pretty strong and upset a couple teams in the conference tournament. So I thought I did enough to save my job for at least another year, and it just didn't pan out that way. Mm-hmm. So it was unfortunate. Had 3 years left of my contract. You know, I was hoping USC couldn't afford to have to pay me that, but they did. They could afford it to do it in 3-year installments. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was it.
So, and it was during that time, mm-hmm, that the Badgers had their back-to-back Final Fours.
Yeah.
You alluded to that.
Yeah.
How much were you able, you know, coaching another team, yeah, how much were you able to...
To watch.
Yeah.
I watched a lot. Yeah, I was able to watch a lot. I would, you know, get our game ready, or we would play off games from them. You know, like we play on a Wednesday, they play on a Thursday, something like that, or vice versa. So I would be able to catch a little bit of their games. And I always wanted to see, because we're running the same stuff. I would always, mm-hmm, want to watch and see what Bo was doing and, mm-hmm, how they were playing. So I would maybe DVR some games and just kind of see if I could pick up a couple things here and there. A couple tweaks, you know, just to help my team.
Right.
See what I could pick up, you know. So I would do that a lot.
And how much pride did you feel in, you know, a couple of those kids that were on those Final Four teams were kids that you brought in. So,
yeah,
you know, even though you weren't,
yeah,
there anymore.
That was the only saving grace for me, was the fact that I helped, you know, bring in some kids that made a difference. And like I said earlier, you know, like I knew I did my job. You know, I left there knowing that I brought good quality kids to Bowl, and not knowing that they were NBA players or guys that were going to do that. It was just, I knew I brought them good quality kids that were going to get better and develop and, you know, and just help them, you know, help them win games. It was just fortunate that those guys were the instrumental pieces to a Final Four runs, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was great, especially watching Frank come into his own. You know, that was really fun to watch. And, you know, the fact that, you know, Frank always, you know, pointed to the fact that I discovered him and believed in him. You know, it always made me feel like, hey, you know, I was appreciated. You know, that was all you want. You know, I didn't need any accolades or any mentions, but, mm-hmm, you know, it does make you feel good when people remember you and keep that in mind, that you were a part of it.
Okay. Just a couple more things.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could tell the story of what then brought you back now as an assistant coach.
So obviously I got let go in March of 2015 from UIC. I'm sitting at home trying not to feel sorry for myself, because I'm big on not being a victim. I don't believe in victims. You know, it's just, you know, I'm fortunate to reach a goal in my life that, you know, obviously it didn't pan out the way I wanted it to, but I was able to achieve a big goal in my career and my life as being a head coach, especially in my hometown. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know what? The Badgers are down at the United Center. I'm going down there. I'm going to watch my college team. I'm going to be a Badger. I'm always going to be a Badger. No one can take that from me. I get fired as a head coach of UIC Flames, but I'm going to always be a Badger. So I go. I always kept some Badger gear in the closet. So put on my Badger gear, grab my son, call the ticket office and get some tickets down there. And we watch Purdue. Then play Purdue in the quarterfinal, I'm sorry, in the semifinal, and then Michigan State in the championship game. But the best thing is, when I got there, you know, you feel like you got this sign on your back that says fired coach, and the Badger fans could care less. They were so happy to see me. I was embraced. It was like they didn't even care, and no one even knew. So it made me feel foolish that I was a little ashamed, but you know, but it also made me feel so much better to get that love from, you know, the people that knew me when I was that 17-year-old kid that got here in August. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to go through that was great, to watch them win. And after the championship game, the next day when I came back to watch them win the championship, I was able to get into the locker room area and the back area with the team and watch the NCAA tournament brackets and everything. And it was kind of catch up with Frank and catch up with Duye and all those guys. And, you know, it was good, you know. You know, talked to Bo a little bit. But the biggest thing that came out of that, Troy, was I'm sitting in the stands and I see the BTN guys. So I see Steve Bardo, I see Sean Morris, who are friends of mine. And I asked them, I said, you know what? You know, they heard about what happened to me, and I told them thanks for, you know, thinking of me of everything and sending me messages. But I said, well, who was the guys in charge of the hiring at BTN. And he said, oh, this guy named Quentin Carter. Hey, stand right there. Hey, let's introduce you to him. So I meet Quentin. We talk a little bit. We exchange information. You know, he gave me his card and everything. He said, yeah, we'll see what happens. So fast forward, the Badgers make the Final Four. And Q emails me and says, hey, if you're going to be at the Final Four, could you come down to the Badgers hotel lobby? We're going to be filming shows from the lobby. So I looked at it as like, this is a interview. This is a, you know, like kind of a test run to see how I do, you know, an audition. So I get the best suit I have, get dappered up, and I go down there, and I try to, and that was great. I'm on there with Bardo and Dave Rezin and Jimmy Jackson, and you know, and it was fun. And I just really showed energy and showed, you know, that I know what I'm doing and I like this and understood the dynamics of doing TV and doing interviews. And it was fun. And afterwards, Q was like, hey, you know, I'm going to give you a call when everything settles down and sometime in the summer. And we'll talk. So fast forward, he sets up a true audition at the Big Ten Studios with Rick Pizzo, who's another personality there. Mm-hmm. And we do a mock show. And they already sent me the film when I was on a breakdown. They sent me, you know, so I was prepared. So I get in there and I do my thing and I kill it. I knock it out the park. And so they offer me a contract as a freelance analyst, basketball analyst for the season. And I was working it. And fast forward a couple months later, we're in December. And we had the Wisconsin-Texas Pan-American game on. Not Pan-American, but Corpus Christi. Mm-hmm. And we're about to do the finale, which breaks down the whole day in the Big Ten, and we do the talk and highlights and all that. So we started the first segment, and then we go away to commercial, and then our producers in our ears in the microphone are like, guys, we got to cut the show. Bo Ryan's got a big announcement at the Kohl Center. So the whole studio turns to look at me to see if I knew what was going on. And I'm like, guys, I have no clue. I'm not privy to what's going on in this situation. So we go back, obviously, and the rest is history. Bo retires. Greg's is introduced as interim. It's just bizarre, really bizarre, and just crazy. I'm sitting there as a Badger, former player, former assistant under this guy. And, you know, they asked me to just kind of give a speech about Bo and just give my thoughts and my feelings and say what I want to say. So I give this heartfelt speech about what Bo meant to this program, to this university, to the state of Wisconsin, and you know, what he meant to me and my family, and giving me the opportunity to come back. So it was like really off the cuff, but it went over really well. So then we finished the show, and then Jess Settles, who played against me at Iowa during our time, he was working with us, and he looks at me and says, you know, this is your last show, right? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Because I'm stunned. Like, I'm all messed up. And he's like, why wouldn't Greg call you? It only makes sense. And I'm sitting like, oh, shoot, there is a spot open now. Greg moved up, so now there's a spot open. And I'm like, wow, okay, what am I going to do? Because we're in Chicago area. We're living in Naperville. We're kind of settled. I had 3 years left in my deal, so I didn't, you know, working at BTN didn't mess with the money that UIC owed me because it's a non-basketball-related job. So whatever I made at BTN was just icing on top of my cake. So why would I leave the comforts of that for the next 3 years? Well, the only reason I would leave is because of Wisconsin. And so Greg calls me that next day. Now, I missed his first call because I was doing a lot of being in the media. A lot of the national media outlets were calling me and getting my thoughts about Bo and everything. So I was out of it. So that afternoon, around this time, he called me and said, hey, what's going on, man? I said, you tell me, you know. And he said, hey, I need you to come back and help me get this thing going. Would you come back? And I said, absolutely, man. I'll be there as soon as I can. So, obviously, they expedited all of the HR stuff and got that all squared away. I signed my contract, and I come back. And, you know, there was a lot of cleaning up we had to do. Just, you know, we took it for granted how good we were with Frank and Sam and all those guys and Nigel and Bronson and Shoei and Vito, those guys were trying to transition into being the leaders, being the guys. And it was a tough transition. I don't know if you remember, but we lost to Western Illinois at home. the day we unveiled the Final Four banner. And I was at that game, so I saw where we were from an analyst standpoint, from a media standpoint, outside of the box, watching from a short distance. And I knew it was going to be a tough job to get this team back on track, but we had potential. I watched the game at home when we beat Syracuse at Syracuse in ACC Big Ten Challenge. And so you saw signs, you know, I saw when we beat VCU, you know. So I'm like, this team is more than capable. We just got to get on track. So as a staff, we promised, we just talked about getting back to the basics, getting better defensively, man, really reinforcing the defensive principles that we've always had, putting the swing in for whatever reason. Well, I know why, but Bo took out the swing when he had Frank and those guys because he just wanted to give them freedom to play. Swing put you on tracks a little bit, and those guys needed the tracks more, this group that we inherited. So we got them organized that way, and it just really gave guys their roles. It gave them some, you know, some comfort and a little bit more structure, and we were able to get on a run. We beat Michigan State here, and we had like an 8-game win streak, and that turned everything around. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the run to the Sweet 16, and the rest is history. We got that interim tag off Greg's name. Mm-hmm. I moved my family up to Madison, and we haven't looked back.
Right. So. And so one more thing before just getting your general final thoughts.
Yeah.
You told me before we started recording the first time that you're in grad school.
Yes.
Here.
Yes.
So why did you decide to reinvest, if you will, in your education while you were here?
Well, you know, for one, being back in Wisconsin, it obviously brought back the memories of being a student and what it meant to me. I always wanted to get my master's, but I never had that opportunity because I just wanted to make money. You know, I was just so used to being broke and so used to not having money. When I started making it, it was difficult for me to take a step back and say, okay, I'm going to go back and get my degree. I heard about the ELPA program, Education Leadership and Policy Analysis. There were other faculty members that were in the program, and we were able to work through it. So it gave me the green light to say, if they can do it, I can do it. And the one thing the UIC situation taught me was, you know, is that I'll never limit myself to one avenue. So getting my degree, my master's degree in ELPA, it just allows me to have different avenues to go down as I get older. So no one's going to put me in a box. No one's going to keep my options limited. I feel like when I get this master's, it's going to open more doors for me in the next 20 years of my life that I want to work and be able to do other things other than just coaching, if it comes down to it.
Great. So the last question is sort of a big picture question, and that's specifically those 4 years. I know you've been back at a couple different stints, but those 5 years really, mm-hmm. as a student athlete.
Sure.
How did that prepare you for, you know, who you are right now?
Well, you know, definitely taught me how to deal with adversity, how to balance the good times and the bad times, to learn from both, to grow from both. Madison is always going to be, it always has been and always will be a very special place for me. I met my wife here. My kids were born here. Some of my best and you know, most impactful relationships are here. So this place is more like home to me than Chicago in a lot of ways. And I grew up here. You know, I was able to go from being truly a boy to a man here in Madison. And so, you know, my affection for this place, it goes without words, what it means to me. You know, it's really, I can't put a price tag on it because I've gained so much from this place. And so, you know, when I talk about Madison, you know, when I try to express to people how great of a place it is, not because of buildings and facilities and the bells and whistles of a arena or whatever, it's people. It's people. I've had people that care for me. When I was in my worst place, there were people that stepped up to help me get out of that rut. Mm-hmm. You know, when it came down to me coming back, it was always people driven, you know, guys that I built relationships with, like a Greg Gard, you know, and people that, you know, a guy like Bo Ryan that believed in me, you know, when he turned me down 2 or 3 times to work for him. And then all of a sudden, when it was like the most, you know, opportune time to come back. He calls me. I didn't have to call him to interview. So, you know, it always go back. The stories always draw to how people affected my life. And there's always been great people here to help me and guide me. And so that's why it's only fitting that I'm in a role now where I can mentor and guide and help and give these young people what they need to be successful, just like I was given the same opportunities.
I think that's a fitting place to end. So thank you, Howard. This concludes Oral History with Howard Moore.
Thanks for having me.